Hello and welcome to Sean White's Solar and Energy Storage Podcast. Today we have a special guest. We have Joe McCabe. He's got so many different things that he's done in the industry. I can't just explain it in a couple of words, so it will take this whole podcast just to even identify his job. Joe is a professional engineer. He's in Colorado, I believe, right now, probably. That's where he lives. And all kinds of really cool, interesting stuff. On his LinkedIn profile, he goes by Renewable Energy Steward. So, hey, Joe, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Yeah, I could remember the first time I could say that I think that I met you or recognized you. It was at one of these ACES conferences somewhere around 2008. And you were the important guy in the room, and you were walking around, and you took enough time to come by and say hi to me and my friends, and we were volunteering for ACES. We were probably like stuffing the tote bags and stuff back in those days, and Great. You were an ACES fellow.
I were. It's all about the people, so I really try to network as much as possible and see what role I'll play. Like, who would have known that I said hi to you, and now we're doing a podcast?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And so ACES, for some people might not know what that means. And so that's the American Solar Energy Society. That's the first ever solar organization in the modern world. So we're not talking about the sun god Ra and the Egyptian pyramids, except you might have been there. I don't know. I mean, you've been in the industry for so long.
And former life. Yeah. I was somehow involved.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. That's great. We're getting into past lives. So now you know what our religion is, everybody. We're one of those religions.
And yeah. American Solar Energy Society is about 70 years old right now. I think they're having their anniversary. Started with solar hot stuff and then morphed into this amazing sunlight to electricity industry we see today. In 2008, when I met you, it was the ACES heyday, really influential with public policy. And since then, gone down a little bit, but I'm trying to see what my role is to play to help it along in the future.
Yeah, I'm president of an ACES chapter right now, right. NorCal Solar, and we're having our 50th birthday party this year. And it's going to be on April 26th. And that is also Bill Brooks's birthday. We're going to talk a little bit about him because I see on LinkedIn that you are connected in a certain way. And then, but another thing too is it's the 50th birthday of NorCal Solar, but it's the 70th birthday of ACES. And in ACES is related to the International Solar Energy Society, ISIS, the good ISIS, been around for a lot longer than the bad one. And so, are you also working with ISIS in any ways, or I guess they were the same organization perhaps and they split off? Do you know about that?
Yeah, that's a little bit past stuff. I've done chapters in ISIS Advances in Solar Energy with Mark Fitzgerald, and I've done other BIPV chapters in their previous publications. But I guess I've been in the Potomac Region Solar Energy Association in Washington, D.C. I was on the board of that directors. I was on NorCal Solar Board of Directors when I lived outside of Davis, California. Great. I've been an advisor to the Colorado Renewable Energy Society, which is an ACES chapter also. And I'm a life member of that and ACES. So anyway, I can teach by example of become a life member of your local state American Solar Energy chapter. I've also been a state chapter representative. So at the annual meetings, all the state chapters would come together and talk about what works for them and what doesn't work for them, and real lessons learned activity at every annual American Solar Energy Society.
Yeah. One thing I've kind of noticed about some of the ACES chapters and things like that, especially here in California, is our goal, our mission was to promote solar energy and let people know what it is. And so we've met our goal. And everybody's too busy to go volunteer for a nonprofit. And it was funny, when solar wasn't such a big thing, these nonprofits were a bigger thing than they are now. And so we're trying to sort of reinvent ourselves. And ACES, too, used to be a lot larger, and it might have something to do with competing with the big conference organizations. There's like professional conference organizations out there and trying to make it so they have the biggest conference and make the most.
Yeah, there's industry associations, and those are big business now. It's amazing. Mm-hmm. Every larger state has a solar industry association, and usually now there are solar and storage industry association. But there's an example in Wisconsin of ACES chapter, and they have 60,000 members, and they have this huge annual 60, energy 000. Fair in the middle of nowhere, Wisconsin, where people still get together and solar cook and talk about off-grid systems and straw bale construction, and just really interesting, like-minded people getting together.
So you're talking about MREA, I believe. Right?
Yeah, Midwest Renewable Energy Association, which has, I think, a few chapters around, but there's just some Wisconsin activity that in a bifurcated political state, I think they are really interesting.
Well, pretty awesome.
As an example. Yeah.
And so 60,000, that's a huge number.
Yeah. And they get tens of thousands of people every summer go to this remote location and teach each other.
Yeah, really, I got to go to that. I haven't made it there yet, and I've been meaning to do that. So sounds like a lot of fun.
Yeah, and smaller versions of that all across the country.
Great. Okay, so we were talking a little bit about you getting into the industry early, and I was looking over at your LinkedIn profile. And then I also know just from looking at Bill's LinkedIn profile, and you can see that there's recommendations there. And yours is the first recommendation. And so I'm going to read this right now. And here's your recommendation. Known Bill since his days at the North Carolina Solar Center. Then we both landed in Northern California. He at Indicon doing all necessary things for the PV industry that makes it what it is today. Successful. And of course, Brooks Engineering is the premier consulting place if you need someone who knows his stuff. Straight up, honest guy. I've said that I'd give Bill a kidney if he ever needed one. Offer still stands. So, Joe, I was just talking to Bill, and he said he needed two kidneys. What, you think he could pull that off?
Yeah, after I offered him a kidney if he ever needed one, I realized you can only do that to one person. Uh-huh. You know, you can't offer it to two people. I happen to have the pleasure of seeing him again a couple weeks ago at the PV Reliability Workshop at NREL, otherwise known as the biggest nerd fest in the nation. And it was good to see him. We've done road trips together and worked, not together, but in the same organization at BEW Engineering, which has since, they've changed their name so many times, but pretty cool consulting on photovoltaics for the last 20 years. I guess it might have been Endicon before it became BEW. I can't remember the whole history of that.
Great, great. Did that's a pretty good offer for a kidney. I mean, geez.
Yeah. Just one is the answer, Bill.
Yeah, just one for Bill. Okay, Bill.
It's like Halloween, the candy bowl. You can't just grab everything. You just get your fair share.
And so he said he has two good kidneys, but he'll still take that other one because if you have three, he can process things better. Maybe he can take up being a heavy drinker or something like that. You know. And still wake up feeling chipper.
Yeah. Luckily, I don't drink, so I can make that offer.
Yeah. Okay. That's a good one. And so let's see some other things. You were just talking about the biggest nerd fest. So what's that all about?
It's annual, and it was in Albuquerque, which they really did a great job given the feel of the Southwest at those conferences. But it's mostly researchers and people who are on the ground with the technology and understand the reliability of photovoltaics and how to increase it.
So it's been going on since the 90s. Is that affiliated with Sandia? Because Sandia is out there in Albuquerque.
It was. And Sandia people show up if they're allowed to travel to this. It's now pretty held by NREL at the Sheridan in Golden, Colorado.
Great.
But still a good feel of the people. Here's why it's interesting. Everybody has to bring content in a poster or in a presentation. You can't just show up. If you are doing a presentation, you can have a guest, but it's interesting in that regard because it makes people part, not just be taking, but also giving. And a lot of networking and not a lot of self-promotion, but there's always a little bit of a bent with whatever people's topic are, because it's what they do for a living. So answer your question? The nerd
fest? Some manufacturers and stuff maybe show up and stuff like that too. And you don't want the people that are praying for photovoltaic unreliability there too, I guess. That's why you...
Actually, there are not manufacturers there, and there was no exhibits, except this time there was one huge bifacial module that NREL person brought along just to show what it looked like. It was just mounted on a wooden frame. But mostly because I've seen it evolve over the years, the hail and weather events were so prevalent in this particular photovoltaic reliability workshop this past year. Really interesting how things evolve.
So you said huge bifacial PV module. So let's maybe talk a little bit about that. So bifacial means that it can capture light from both sides. And also something that's kind of interesting with bifacial is it's exempt from tariffs to a certain degree. And I know that keeps going back and forth.
That was a ping pong a couple of years ago. I had a hard time keeping track of, okay, what's today and what is the rule today? I've been watching that technology for about 25 years, and it was just enormously expensive back then in comparison to single-sided solar.
Boring old monofacial. Instead of like bifacial or trifacial, quadrifacial, septifacial.
Well, it was interesting to me because I was doing some modeling. It's called BIPV Designer, free shareware that would allow you to show how many surfaces you have and how much electricity you could gain from them. And it had a shading module and things like that. So while developing that software, and that was for Solar Design Associates, Stephen Strong commissioned that. Really fun. You can just spin the building design and see how the annual or monthly effects. But I realized a vertical bifacial system produces more electricity annually than an optimally tilted single facial module. Well, at that time, it was very, very expensive. It didn't make sense. I thought, well, let's just put that in the back burner and think about that for a while. And now the costs have come down so much that you can hang a photovoltaic module like a leaf and make electricity off both sides of it, like a leaf would make chlorophyll.
Yeah, leaves are bifacial. That's pretty neat.
Yeah, it was always interesting to me. Biomimicry is a term that I try to watch out for. So nowadays, there's this agrivoltaics, and I have a website, agrisoltaics, because no one really knows what a volt is, that can just hang vertically modules and farm in between. So it's kind of interesting how the technology has come less and less expensive and enabled now dual use of land. But there's some other really interesting electrical cost reduction and structural cost reductions that are enabled when you just hang a solar module. So I'm really bullish on bifacial technology.
Awesome. Yeah. And so when they do put bifacial up, like you were talking about, to capture the light from both sides, when you put it vertical, we would call that a 90 degree tilt, they would typically face it east and west. Is that correct?
Yeah. But I recently, I guess it was 2 years ago, I presented at the PV Reliability Workshop that it doesn't matter. Actually, I did a SAM. There's a free software out there from NREL, System Advisor Model is what it's called. And they recently did a module with bifacial capabilities. And it has shading effects and things like that. But I spun the system around and around in different cities. And it doesn't really, it's like a 10 to 15% difference. The orientation isn't critical. Latitude, the higher the latitude, the better, because the sun is lower in the sky often, especially in the highest values of summer months. So I don't know if that was interesting or not, but it was to me.
And I would think too that if you are facing it different directions and things like that, you also might want to take into consideration not just how much energy you make in a year, which a lot of times that's what we were traditionally doing, but as there's more and more solar out there, it gets more important to not make it all in the middle of the day. So like if it was facing south. And so that's one of the big benefits of going east and west is you make some in the morning and then especially more importantly, the afternoon.
Yeah, it's called bimodal. And so in the middle of the morning is your highest amount of electricity in the middle of the evening, but also pushes out a few hours into the late evening that you are still making electricity when it's the highest value to society. There's a little bit more interesting stuff that you never get 100% sun on these surfaces, so it never gets hot. And the warranty is directly related to how hot it's gotten in its whole lifetime. So you get 75% direct solar on these surfaces as opposed to 100. And that also reduces the short circuit current, getting a little nerdy here, but you reduce electrical balance of systems by 25% because you never have that high current, which is what you have to address in any electrical system, the highest amount of current is received. So this is just a little fun stuff with that.
Yeah, and that's interesting too, that a lot of people think like, oh, with bifacial, I need to think that the current's going to be more as far as, you know, for wire sizing. And so you base that off of the what's called the short circuit current. And you multiply times 1.25 and there's another 1.25 in there somewhere. And so what you're saying is since you're not directly facing the sun, actually, your short circuit current is going to be less with these applications.
Yes.
You know, vertical and things like that. So that's cool.
So you save a few cents per kilowatt installed because the electrical balance of systems can be lower. It doesn't matter if it's a micro inverter or a string inverter or central station, you save.
Yeah, you might save even more because you would have a potentially smaller inverter, larger PV to inverter ratio, inverter load ratio.
Absolutely. Yeah, and that's what I did in the poster 2 years ago was I did a high DC-AC ratio with storage. And that's really interesting because it's called clipping. You have so much DC before the inverter, you have extra DC available and you can put it into storage. And the optimization there is really interesting, whether for grid connected or standalone.
So do you think if we put bifacial on a rotisserie and spun it really fast, we can make alternating current?
I've actually looked at that a little bit, the 60 hertz. Yeah, and I've actually patented pivoting along the upper edge of a bifacial hanging. If you hang a bifacial module and just attach it to the upper edge, it'll pivot in the wind. So this actually reduces the need for a frame. The forces of nature are uniform across the module at all times. And it actually lifts the module up and will go vertical at 80 miles per hour. So for resilience in hurricane and tornadoes and flying debris, you no longer have the cross-sectional area that a normal module has. So that reduces the structural cost. It's just a cable that can hang modules if it's allowed to freely swing along the upper edge.
Did you know that my great-great-grandparents had a solar system like that? It's called a clothesline.
It was great. And some communities don't allow that. Colorado has a law that says homeowners association cannot restrict clotheslines or basically solar systems. That's a
That's solar and wind even. That's like super renewable energy.
It is very effective. Not in humid places, but somehow where I live in Colorado, it's very effective.
Yeah, but I guess you can also duplicate the benefits of a clothesline with just special fabric softeners, right? Just kidding. And so another thing that when you mentioned, you said it was like a giant bifacial module. And that's another thing that's kind of been happening lately is the size of the solar cells and the solar modules have been increasing. And a lot of people that are not in the know think like, oh, the efficiency is getting better. And the efficiency was always gradually getting better, but it's not doubling or anything like that. Unless you go back really far, you could just say doubling since maybe the 80s on your average efficiency, something like that.
The 550 watts is what was showing at this event, just one module. And people kind of surrounded around it and were putting coffee cups on top of it and just talking all kinds of things at this module. I thought was kind of funny. I want to start a new pledge that no one ever talks about efficiency ever again. Because it isn't the most important thing. I mean, the total levelized cost of energy is what we should be always talking about.
Yeah, I agree.
The efficiency seems to be the person on the street wants to know what's the efficiency these days. And yeah, it has been increasing percentages here and there. It has gotten us to where we are today, but it's not the most important thing to talk about.
Yeah, and efficiency, you know, if it doesn't cost anything to get efficiency, of course, it can lower your levelized cost of electricity, but there's just a lot more to it. And another thing, too, that I think that it kind of misleads people with is thinking that they need to replace their older PV systems because they're 10 years old, just like you would replace your computer or your car or something like that. And they're making the same sine waves, watt for watt, kilowatt for kilowatt, megawatt for megawatt. And so I don't think there's a big reason to just go tear them apart and put something on because it's a little bit more efficient, something like that.
I'd agree. But there are times if a storm came through or some other, you need a new roof, that's a good time to think about replacing the system. It's pretty expensive just to take a system off and then put it back on. And I've done some analysis on reuse and recycle of solar modules. And this was SMUD.
So that's Sacramento Municipal Utility District, SMUD.
One of the first utilities to really embrace solar because they had to close down a nuke plant and they felt that was the best alternative at the time. But 10, 12 years later, they had to take some systems out for whatever reason. And from an analysis standpoint, I thought that was an opportunity. So I bid on and won a bunch of these bulk purchase of solar modules. And what do you do with them? Well, I was trying to figure out what's the value proposition, eBay, Craigslist, selling surplus modules. Turns out half of the modules were no longer useful because the junction box was broken or just something wrong with it. And then I realized you have to immediately put the system back into use. There's no room for extra transportation and storage of the modules because of every touch is expensive. So that was kind of an enlightening thing. And now with the prices so low on modules, you get no warranty with a used module and you can't really participate in tax incentives and things like that. So it's really a recycling kind of thing these days.
Yeah. And so if anybody has some old modules they want to get rid of, just give me a call and I'll take them off your hands. I put 53 of them on my mom's house and they seem to be offsetting her bill pretty well. I've got them facing in every direction. Another thing that I tell people to do is to take the old ones when they're going to replace them with new ones and just put the older ones on the north side of the roof. And on the north side of the roof, a lot of times you're making about 2/3 of the annual energy that you would make on the south side of the roof.
There's a lot of diffuse light and summertime east sunrise and sunset has good value. I would caveat that, but I did load up a pickup truck and on the side of the road in the right place, I was selling modules out the door. And this was at Mother Truckers up in the Sierra Nevadas, Jackass Flats Road.
Really?
I had my son, who was like 6 years old at the time, just had a sign that said PV. And everybody had a grow operation up there and knew what PV was. And I was selling those modules out the pickup back bed.
I would have loved to see that or see some pictures of that. You should be in the PV Museum. What year was that?
That would have been in 2010 timeframe.
Wow. Okay, that's pretty cool. And then do you know what county that was?
It's outside of Grass Valley.
Grass Valley.
The slope there. Mine-tailing territory of yesteryear. But everybody understands solar because that's all. Everybody's off-grid and they all had their own grow operation, which was illegal then, but is legal now. So
yeah, now all those guys are, they went from being millionaires to being poor. Because I guess the price went down like 20-fold or something like that, like PV. If you were making homemade PV, it might not work so well anymore.
That's true. Yeah.
We interrupt you for a very important announcement. Sean White's Solar and Energy Storage Podcast has been brought to you by Sean White's Solar and Energy Storage Podcast. That's right. Sean White is sponsoring his own podcast. And he wants to remind you to go check out some of his classes. You can go to solarsean.com and then click on the links to check out his classes. You can check out his heat spring classes, and you can also hire him to teach classes for you, like at your company, something like that. Now back to the show. So let's see some other things. I saw that you're NABCEP certified. And so NABCEP stands for North American Board of Certified Energy Practitioners. And by the way, I just got back from the NABCEP conference and it was a whole lot of fun. You were probably early in on that, right?
I want to talk about Mark Fitzgerald if you're going to bring up NABCEP. So this guy made NABCEP happen through IREC. And Jane Weissman was running IREC at the time. Mark Fitzgerald is no longer with us, but the industry really owes a debt of gratitude to this guy who went around in the early days of solar and said, we need people who know what they're doing installing this stuff from now on and have a stamp of approval that these people know what they're doing. I really didn't necessarily buy in at the time, but I recognize in hindsight how important that was. And I just got a passion for the lengths that that guy had to go through to get this whole industry to have a certification of people who know what they're doing. And it's really enabled us to become what we are today, a safe installations of low cost renewable energy. So to answer your question, yeah, I was teaching at a local community college, the introductory to photovoltaics, and getting those students and ready for the NABCEP entry level certification. I probably am not NABCEP certified now because I haven't kept it up.
Sure.
So you can bug me about that. And I should do that. I don't know if that answers your question.
Yeah, great. And so you probably took the NABCEP exam a long time ago, I guess?
Again, probably that was around 2010.
Around 2010 or something like that. Great. Yeah. Yeah. And I was talking 2 days ago at the NABCEP conference to Ward Bauer. You probably know who he is.
Oh, he was, praise Ward. So there's a group of people that have had to sit on standards and codes meetings. John Wolgemuth, George Kelly. They just shine with, again, how they made the industry what it is today, that these codes and standards had to happen so that everything was the foundation that was built so we could have this industry in today. What about Ward?
Yeah. So, well, I was just talking to him, and he is sort of like the godfather of solar, some people call him. And he invented the grid tie inverter at Sandia Labs in 1977. He was kind of starting NABCEP. I know he like got a phone call. He was on the beach and they said, hey, you need to go start this thing because people are not installing solar right. And so that's the beginnings of how NABCEP happened. But anyway, he said he's going to be on the podcast. He's kind of retired now, but he's just like the super nicest guy you ever met.
Absolutely. Northern New Mexico. I think he's fishing as John Wolgemuth tries to do. Sometimes they get pulled back in the industry.
Yeah, he still sits on the NABCEP board. So he's on the board of directors of NABCEP. I think they just had their big meeting yesterday. And by the way, too, when people are listening to this, we record it, but we don't release it right away because there's other podcasts that are on the queue. So just when I say yesterday, it doesn't mean yesterday. And so he's on the board. He sits on these exam committees. I was on the PVIP exam committee with Ward. That's how I got to know him. And we went to Sandia Labs and NREL and all these different places together. And so that's how I got to know him. And he still is on these different exam committees. And so when you're on these exam committees, you write the test questions and you sit around and hang out with a bunch of smart people. So it's pretty neat. And so, like, since you've been in the PV industry for so long, did you know Edmund Becquerel? What was he like? That's a joke.
There's a formula with his name on it, right? He found it in the late 1800s, the photoelectric effect. Is that?
Yeah. So, well, Einstein was the photoelectric effect and Becquerel was the photovoltaic effect. And have to know a lot to even understand what the differences is. Yeah. So he was like a teenager in the 1800s. And he found out that you could make electricity from light. So you take electromagnetic radiation, you take light, you turn it into electricity. And that was before they even knew what to do with electricity, making light bulbs and Thomas Edison and all that kind of stuff. So
let me go a little deeper than that. And what's happening is that you're on a computer right now. And in that computer is semiconductor material. It's semiconductor, conducts, or it resists. And a photon comes into, let's just say, silicon, which has four electric orbits, one of which is free if it's given a little bit of energy. So the photon comes in and excites the one electron out of silicon so it can go up into a conduction band. And that then goes through a wire, does work in your light or charges your battery or moves your motor, and then comes back into the backside of the photovoltaic cell. So this photon is an excitatorial catalyst that enables an electron to go into the conduction band and then go do work and come back. This is why I got into this industry when I was in high school. I read about this and I thought, how cool, make electricity from a little bit of sunlight. And now it's just mind-boggling where we are today at the gigawatt stage of systems.
That's a lot. How many photons in a gigawatt?
Yeah, go figure. Lots of 23s.
Yeah, like some power. Kind of something like one less than an infinity or something like that.
It's 1,000 watts per square meter. Now, we've got some kind of enlightened being that enabled that number to happen because it's so easy. We've got and the sunlight is 1,000 watts. It's a hair dryer for every square meter of surface area. And how well you convert that at the right time is what we've been doing in the industry.
So I guess that kind of just proves that we're living in a simulation.
Not necessarily.
So that's pretty cool. And I really like that explanation that you had there too, with you just knock it up and you get the photons, it knocks that electron loose, gets it on one side of that solar cell, and it's easier to go back the other way than to go back where it came from, because it's like a diode. It is a diode, I guess. It's a, you know, one-way
a
street.
Diode blocks it or passes. It's quantum mechanics, which is really cool. It's really humanity's evolution into this science of quantum, where in the past we would make electricity out of the thermodynamic science. That's the hotter it is, the more efficient it is. Photovoltaics, the colder it is, the more efficient it is. So I just love those differences in this industry.
That's crazy. So you seem to be pretty good at this kind of stuff. I did see that you have a degree in nuclear engineering. And so I was going to ask you about that too. Did you set up that fusion plant on the sun? Have you ever been to the sun? What's it like up there? Do you have to wear a lot of sunscreen? And I was like,
I haven't been there in this life. I do wear as much sunscreen as possible. You know, Kurt Vonnegut or sunscreen. The nuke energy degree was because at the time, no one could pronounce photovoltaics, but mostly there was no degree in photovoltaics. And the math is the same for how a neutron works in a nuclear reactor as the photon that I described before, Schrodinger equation. It's all the same math. So that's why I did a master's degree in nuclear engineering at the University of Arizona. But I also ran the solar energy research facility there. Now, this NREL was originally called SURF, but this one might have predated it. It was on the civil engineering roof. And it was mothballed, but it was fun to be in Tucson with all the sun and doing solar and straw bale construction. So I was in a reactor, literally had my head in a research reactor with the blue glow. And in the afternoon, I take a bus to do research on the insulating value of straw bales for construction out of the airport in Tucson. So that was kind of fun dichotomy.
That's pretty cool. About what year was that going on?
1992, when I started that degree. This guy named Mats Meerman in Tucson revitalized the straw bale construction world, and nobody knew what the insulating value was. Nobody could say for their home energy rating systems, what was the R value of this huge brick? And I did the research and California adopted it. So it was kind of fun at the time.
Yeah. And straw bales, that's where the third little pig lives, right? Or is it
the first?
Yes. I can't remember.
Yes. Built a bunch in the right climate. It makes a lot of sense. And definitely in the Southwest, it makes a lot of sense.
And can we go back to, like, right before you said straw bale, there was like a, what was it, a nuclear or solar research institute? What was that again?
Solar Energy Research Facility, SERF, S-E-R-F.
SERF, okay.
Yeah, and NREL was called a SERF before it became NREL.
I remember it was like SERI or something before too, like a Solar Energy Research Institute.
Dennis Hayes ran that, the first appointed by the president.
Carter?
Yeah, in 76, 78, 4, something like that. But there was a SERF out at SERI at the time.
Oh, okay. So there was a SERF out at SERI. So SERI, Solar Energy Research Institute, started by Jimmy Carter, who's still with us, 99 years old. He's another solar saint, putting solar on the White House and all that kind of stuff. And so you were working at SERF, and you said something about a blue light. It sounds like ET or something like that, or Close Encounters.
What's the question?
So what was the blue light? You said something about a blue light.
Oh, if you look in a reactor, neutron scatter is blue.
So hold on a second. You're looking in a reactor. That sounds dangerous to me.
Yeah, you wear a badge and it's underwater.
Can we learn more about that? Like, what's up with that?
So it's neutron scatter is making the heat. A neutron hits another neutron and it may or may not split off from material and create heat. Mm-hmm. And what you're doing in the major nuclear reactors is controlling that with cadmium rods up and down. You regulate how much neutron scatter is happening, how much heat is being produced. But these glow blue. Mm-hmm. It's okay. Quite cosmic. Yeah. And the same year I was somehow first author on this neutron scatter paper for Neutron Magazine, I published the straw bale insulating value for construction. So it's kind of weird that I'm in both these really conservative nuclear engineering world and doing this natural building material research.
Yeah, that sounds kind of crazy. And so what kind of reactor was it?
It was a research reactor. It's no longer there, but there was a nuclear engineering department at University of Arizona. And they wanted me to do my master's thesis on IRP, integrated resource plans and stuff like that for Public Utility Commission. And there's so much data on that and no one ever read. And I asked the dean, well, actually, I didn't ask. I told him, I'm going to do this research on straw bale construction. And I've got a facility out at the airport I can do it in. And he's like, most requested master's thesis ever at the University of Arizona Nuclear Engineering Department.
Wow, wow. So maybe you could make a reactor out of straw bales?
No. Bring it down to earth, Sean.
Okay. Darn, down to earth. Okay, let's get a little bit more down to earth. So maybe you can explain to me more about like what a fellow is. And so when I first met you, I was like, oh, he's an ACES fellow. He must be really important. And so there's other types of fellows and things like that. So what is a fellow?
There's rules to be nominated as a fellow, and then you're voted on by the community at large for American Solar Energy Society. Fellow typically is in the university setting, but for this particular American Solar Energy Society fellow, you have had to have been a member for a long time and contributed considerably to the society. And yeah, I bought into ACES in the early 90s and did a lot of chapter representation. And I was the head of the photovoltaic division at ACES and did a lot of other, like NorCal Solar, Potomac Region Solar Energy. And I was not living in Colorado at that time, but knew I would be. So I was a founding member of the Colorado Renewable Energy Society back in the 90s, even though I didn't live in Colorado, I knew I would someday. So a lot of involvement at the main American Solar Energy Society level and the chapters.
Yeah, I remember that Potomac region organization. I think about 15 years ago, they had me go back there and do a talk. I remember it was when I was doing solar training in Philadelphia for this organization called Infinite Solar, but who knows? Maybe we crossed paths there, but it's so long ago.
It's possible.
Yeah. As a fellow, like a Rhodes Scholar, and like, what's a Rhodes Scholar? Is it like somebody that learns on the road? And I'm just kidding. But I remember like with Clinton, he was a Rhodes Scholar. And
it's spelled differently.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it takes a lot to be nominated and then you're voted on by your peers. I don't know if it's official or not, but there's a NorCal Solar person who might be becoming a fellow of American Solar Energy Society soon, I hope. See how that goes.
Yep. Yeah, I was just looking over at the ACES website this morning and checking that out. And it looked like you have to be a member for 10 years and different things like that. And there's a list of people on there. I know like Claudia Wentworth and Elaine Hebert were both presidents of NorCal Solar at one time. And it looks like they're both ACES fellows and probably some other ones there too. I know that one time that I saw Danny Kennedy give a speech for NorCal Solar, this was like probably 2019, right before COVID, and I was on the board at that time, but he said how NorCal Solar kind of started the solar industry in a way, or the PV industry, we could say, because most of the stuff going on was in Northern California as far as like selling solar modules and all that kind of stuff. So I thought that was cool.
Let me give you a different perspective. there's a guy named Carl Weinberg who recently passed away. Utmost respect for him. But he worked at Pacific Gas and Electric in the innovations office. But the guys he hired and taught are the leaders of the solar industry today. Is Dan Sugar, Howard Wenger, just all kinds of real exceptional people. And that's my definition of success. Mm-hmm. If the people who you hire then go off to become phenomenal industry leaders, that I feel was what got the solar industry rolling. PVUSA happened in Davis, California, joint partnership with Department of Energy, Pacific Gas and Electric, SMUD, California Energy Commission. They all joined to show side-by-side solar systems and how well they work in comparison to another in that climate. Really interesting stuff at utility level involvement.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, it's crazy. I wonder like how many thousands of times the solar industry has grown since you started. Like it's many thousands of times. Like just that, how much PV is installed in the world since the beginning of time and all that. It's probably just like many thousands of times since back when you were working on this stuff in the early 90s, I guess.
Do it per watt basis. So a solar module of solar electricity was $9 a watt. And it's around 20 cents a watt now outside the United States.
Yeah.
What we've seen, there's a curve attributed to Richard Swanson called the Swanson curve, but he denies it's his. But it's a log-log relationship of the experience level worldwide and the price of photovoltaics. It's a straight line. The more we learn, it's log-log. So additional terawatts are going to continue to reduce the cost worldwide. But that's what the learning curve of solar is, a straight line in a log-log relationship.
You know, I was thinking like before, with the success of the solar industry, it's kind of got rid of the mission for NorCal Solar to educate people about what solar is about. And then also we're having this other success. And so if we have the same success that we've had growing thousands of times, or even let's just say 1,000 times. So about the year 2000 until about a couple of years ago, I guess 2022, we went from 1 gigawatt in the world to a terawatt in the world. So that's 1,000-fold. And so if we go another 1,000-fold, that would be way more energy than the world could even use. And so we might hit another success point where the whole world has all the cheap energy they can ever use. And then maybe there'll be some layoffs.
We use the word inexpensive. We don't use cheap.
Okay. Yeah. Sorry about that.
I have a feeling.
I've been corrected before on that. Yeah.
Just desalinization of seawater for drinking water could just suck up all kinds of energy. So we'll see what happens.
Yeah. And maybe we go another 10 years or 20 years, but at some point, perhaps even in most of our lifetimes, get to a point where we have all the energy that we want and it's inexpensive and it's from solar and wind.
I've heard this before in the 50s. I wasn't alive, but nuke energy too cheap to meter didn't happen.
Yeah. Okay. All right. We'll see about that. I was just not saying it's going to happen, but I was just kind of thinking a little bit about that. So maybe we could talk a little bit about what you're up to. Says that you're working for the Colorado Public Utilities Commission Fixed Utilities?
Yes, I was. Before I was doing solar professionally, I was in the heating, ventilating, and air conditioning industry, mostly to get my professional engineer's license. And I tried to look at it from all aspects. How do you get things on roofs in the industry? I've parlayed that into the solar industry, beginning with education. We educated the internet with the first 1 million hits per month on renewable energy topic, Center for Renewable Energy and Sustainable Technology, written up in Wired magazine back in the early 90s. And then I worked on BIPV with Solar Design Associates, how to get solar onto buildings. Shading the buildings and making electricity was always my focus. And then I was lucky, just complete luck, at the California Energy Commission. I walked in the door and became a full-time consultant running the research for the state of California on all the things that you see today, funding all kinds of single-axis tracking research, and advancements in value and utilization of solar. Worked in the manufacturing facility on a lightweight thin film flexible copper-iridium diselenide. And just to get to your question more recently, I felt that policy was where the rubber meets the road. How society values these renewable energy, electricity, and the carbon reduction. So I thought I'd be working for 1 year at the Public Utilities Commission, learning proceedings and how cross-examination works and how decisions get made. I stayed for 4.5 years, mostly because my boss was just phenomenal, just a really intelligent, knew every rule and how things worked in the past and how it could work today. So I coined my own name after I left in January that I was a renewable energy steward. I was taking care of the wind and solar in the state of Colorado, making sure the investor-owned utilities were doing what they were supposed to be doing. And mostly it merged into reducing curtailments. I call it undelivered renewable energy. But increasingly, these utilities are not able to deliver the wind and solar. Maybe because there's no demand for it, or maybe there's a bottleneck in transmission or distribution for whatever reason. It was increasing from the 3%, 4%, 5%, which might be understandable for safe operation of the grid, to the 10, and now I'm seeing projections of 15 plus undelivered renewable energy percentages in Colorado. By the way, ISO is also now showing a huge increase in undelivered renewable energy. And I hope people will call it that, not curtailment, which is jargon, or dump energy, which is jargon. I love the Amazon thing that you ordered this product and it wasn't delivered. So the state has ordered and paid for these products, wind and solar, and it's not being delivered. So obviously, I'm pretty passionate about this. Thank you for the opportunity to get on my soapbox.
But, no, that's great.
I'm trying to steward that stuff. But having this experience in the industry we've talked about throughout this whole discussion has led me to this place of that policy is important. If you get a chance, comment in your local policy decision activities. Your voice is important. That's a bottom line, what I was doing for the last 4.5 years. Watching the renewable energy standard. There's a RESA fund that's money that goes towards renewable energy systems in Colorado. And I'm passionate about community solar gardens, which I've started the first one, luckily at SMUD, that saw the ability for a remote system to provide electricity to someone who wants solar but might not be able to install it themselves.
So you're calling it a community solar garden. And so the word garden, I think you mean what I know as community solar, and then instead of maybe calling it a plant or a project, you call it a garden. It sounds kind of nice. It's like a community garden, where people go and grow all their vegetables together and things like that.
Initially, it was called Solar Shares, was the program at SMUD that I got approved at the board of directors level. And something amazing happened that all kinds of copyrights came out at the patent office on what do we call this solar garden? And so in Colorado, the legislation, Claire Levy, 2010, first legislation in the nation, called it Community Solar Gardens. And it's just this phenomenal photo opportunity for politicians to stand in front of a system that was developed that everybody can utilize. So I didn't think I answered your question, but that's the evolution of that term from California, Colorado, and other places.
Great. Great. Awesome. Yeah. Community solar is a big thing. It kind of reminds me of the first time I got involved in solar. I was a sort of a political activist. My best friend at the time, who's still a really good friend, his name's Paul Finn. He came up with community choice aggregation, which is different from community solar. But I know now that over 10% of the country gets their electricity through a CCA. So that's community choice aggregator.
Was he in Marin? I don't know, Finn.
I actually met him first at Jerry Brown's house in Oakland. And he was living in Jerry's house. His wife was Jerry's campaign manager. And he was a political activist. He studied philosophy. And instead of writing philosophy books, he decided to write laws. And so he wrote this CCA law. And I was campaigning with him for his law and things like that. And I was doing a little technical research for him. And that's back in the 90s. So I think somewhere around 95 was when my daughter was born. So somewhere around that time. And that's just where I'm piecing things together right now. Yeah, it was just pretty cool to see somebody just come up with this good idea and write a law. I remember one time he was writing some proposal and he's like, should I make it for a half a billion or a billion? And I was like, oh, make it a billion, you know, and he writes it down. I was like, oh, that's pretty powerful right there. He first wrote the law before I met him in Massachusetts. And then he came out and it got passed in California, it got passed in Ohio. So there's certain states that have CCAs and then other states that don't. If somebody wants to learn more about it, they can go back in history on this podcast. And I interviewed him. Actually, I'm going to go stay at his house in a couple of weeks too. Maybe we'll do another interview.
Yeah, I like community choice aggregation. I don't understand it as much as I would like. I think Colorado is trying to do it. There's some proceedings here. Maybe a little story behind where Community Solar Garden or the initial Solar Shares program came from, because I was managing PVUSA for the state of California.
Also, too, that's a big deal. PVUSA, there's PVUSA testing conditions. You might have came up with 1,000 watts per square meter knowing PVUSA, but it's a test facility. It's still happening. It's still going on. It's over near Davis, California, which is right next to Sacramento.
Yeah. And I was managing the facility and I realized the electricity from these systems wasn't going anywhere on site. It was actually going to a wastewater treatment facility a couple miles away for the city of Davis. And I also saw like Hetch Hetchy Aquifer would wheel the electricity down to the city of San Francisco, which is his own utility. So I found that, wow, the electricity doesn't actually have to be attached to its own meter. It can be attached to a different meter. Mm-hmm. And I started talking to the board of directors and people at SMUD about doing this and then was able to propose it and get it approved of a 2-megawatt system in SMUD. So that was called Solar Shares, but just a little background of PVUSA. And I actually had to write the stuff at the California Energy Commission to transfer the ownership of PVUSA to the city of Davis. And Art Rosenfeld was at the commissioner level, and there were all these commissioners at the business meeting, and nobody had any money. I had a dollar in my pocket, so I was able to loan the city of Davis a dollar so that they could pay the state to buy PVUSA and transact that all the modules on top would now be the property of city of Davis.
Did you get that dollar back?
I never did. So, you know.
I think you probably own that whole municipal utility district by now. Inflation and all that. That's pretty cool. Yeah, I think that policy is super important and it's probably going to be what lags a lot, you know, as we modernize our grid, because, you know, politics is involved and all that kind of stuff. And you have politicians that are more likely to be attorneys than engineers. And so it's hard to have them really know what's going on.
And the modernization of the grid is already inherently in a lot of the solar systems that you see today. They have smart inverter technology that's built in. It's not being utilized. So voltage frequency response, power factor correction, charge and discharge storage, already capable in these boxes that are attached to solar systems. So solar is enabling the modernization through these advanced functionalities. Rule 21 in California leads the way. Smart Inverter Working Group in California, real good entities to be involved with.
How do we find out more about that? Like, that sounds really interesting to me, the Smart Inverter Working Group.
It's like 12 years old. I would have thought we would have come a lot further. But yeah, I don't know the numbers in California, but I know I'm on the mailing list. But SIWG, Rule 21, if you just Google those two things, it'll come up with a California Public Utility Proceedings. And hopefully that'll answer your questions on how to get involved. Really replicated across the nation, how these technologies enabled by the solar industry can modernize the grid and bring value.
Yeah. And so we have like the old type of grid, which is maybe we could call it the stupid grid, but no offense to those people that put that together. They were like super smart. And some of them actually include my grandfather. But we have this old type of grid where you just have these centralized power plants and they send everybody the electricity. And now we have all this distributed power that's all over the place, with solar and wind, and it's intermittent renewables, and energy storage is a key part to that. But there's different ways where we can still stabilize the grid, and we could have 100% renewable grid, just like you could have 100% renewable cabin, but you have to figure out how to make that work with the engineering and the smart inverters. We have grid following inverters, which is phase one, where if you're just 1% of the grid, it doesn't really matter if all the inverters turn off all at once. And then we have grid forming inverters, which are more like standalone in a way. We call them voltage source would be a grid forming inverter, and current source would be a grid following inverter. And then it's not black or white thing too. There's a continuum of in between. We have things like reactive power that helps stabilize the voltage. And those are some of the things that I believe that you're talking about when you talk about Rule 21 and the Smart Inverter Working Group.
Yes. And do you have any classes that you give on these topics, Sean?
Yes, I do. And so I have some of them on HeatSpring. And I have an energy storage installation professional exam prep course that includes a 40-hour advanced energy storage class. That, and I talk about that. And I've also done different classes on this kind of stuff, too, for different utilities and different countries and things like that. And some of these countries are in islands. And I did a class in Sydney, Australia, which was just really cool to go to Australia. And you have some other places like that, too, where they are very forward-looking as far as renewables go, and they have a greater percentage of their grid working off of solar. And so even though Australia is considered a continent, it's kind of like a big island, and it doesn't have a ton of people on it. And so it's a lot more isolated, and it's very sunny. And so that's a really good forward-looking place for solar penetration and the concentration of solar. There's things that are going on in the Caribbean, and there is, of course, there's always Germany. And so the solar saint Hermann Scher, who's pretty much started the modern solar industry, kicked that off. And so Germany is a lot farther along than just about any place. Did you ever meet Hermann Scher?
Maybe once, but he wouldn't recognize my name.
That answers your question. Well, he would now because he is all at one with the universe because he's not with us anymore.
Okay, I didn't know that. I apologize.
Yeah, and he's a politician. And so in Germany, he figured out how to start the feed-in tariff, the FIT. And it was the first time that you could feed the grid. And they set the price for the energy super high. And you could feed the grid and make a profit. And I think they wanted to get like an annual return on investment of something like 9%. And it was like multiple marks per kilowatt hour or something like that when they first did it, and then the price would go down over time. And so that's what kicked off the solar industry, because before it just didn't make sense to feed the grid when it costs you $2 a kilowatt hour to make solar electricity.
Yeah, it's a good market pull. Freiburg, Germany used to have these great international solar conferences, great town, and I thought once I might have met him there, but
you probably did. You went back to those Freiburg conferences. Do you know Ike Weber? He used to run the lab over there in Freiburg, and he was also on faculty at UC Berkeley. And he was the one that brought InterSolar to the United States. And he's been on my sailboat. He's a real neat guy. And I need to go back to that conference that's InterSolar in Europe, but now they call it the Smarter E. And that's in the summer, and it's over in Munich. And so I usually would go to that every summer, but I have my daughter at that time this year, so I'm not going to make it. But also I work with InterSolar too.
Yep. Mm-hmm. InterSolar in San Francisco was always great, and then COVID hit, and now it's in Anaheim, I guess, and I think there might be one in San Diego.
Yeah, I went to that in January, and it was actually a lot of fun. It was the German organization that started InterSolar. They sold it to an American conference company called Diversified, but they're really neat, and it was a great conference. I love the way that it's set up. Just in San Diego, they have a convention center, and it just like leads to the main street and what they call, I guess the gas lamp district. I didn't want to say gas lighting district because it's easy to say. And so it's like you're just walking back and forth to your hotel and you're on the main street in San Diego and you're seeing all these people that you know. And it was kind of a good setup. But they've gone to San Diego and Long Beach since they moved it away from San Francisco. And mm-hmm. so that's the new group. And then we do have the big Anaheim conference, which is RE Plus. That's going to be in September in Anaheim.
Great.
And last year it was in Las Vegas. And there's a lot of RE Plus regional conferences. I'm going to be doing a National Electrical Code workshop in May at RE Plus in Texas. I was at RE Plus doing a National Electrical Code workshop and also doing building codes and things like that too, recently in Massachusetts. And so all of these conferences are a lot of fun. The NABCEP conference was especially fun because you have all the NABCEP certified people there and they're all kind of like really similar to each other and getting their NABCEP CE credit and stuff like that. And so they had an 80s night and I dressed up with a Michael Jackson jacket. And then Sean O'Brien asked me to start off the karaoke. I didn't know what I was going to do. And so I told him to play Michael Jackson, ABC, 1, 2, 3. And I started doing this freestyle. And I was talking about how 690.12b2abc was changed to 690.12b2, 1, 2, 3. And that was just a heck of a lot of fun. Somebody just sent me a video of that this morning that I'm going to try to post somewhere.
But cute.
Yeah, there's lots of fun conferences. And kind of my theory on what to do with education and everything is just to make it fun and to mess around and joke around, and then people will enjoy it. I had a couple of my favorite instructors when I was in college and things like that, and they just made it so you just wanted to go to class. Like you wake up in the morning and you'd be like, oh, I can't wait till class. It's so fun. And then you just kind of learn in the background. I remember this, I had this history professor and he would take us to where that time in history, it was like early American history. And we'd come in and his wife was a musician and he would say like, okay, round up the wagons. And we'd take all our desks and put them in a big circle. And then he'd start playing his harmonica and his wife would pull out the guitar and we'd start singing the old campfire songs like Jimmy Crack Corn. And then he would narrate it. And he's like, you know what cracking corn is? It's making whiskey. And
I didn't know that.
And it was just like, he just made a lot of fun. And then I remember I had this other, his name was John Walzer. He's not with us. And then I had another professor who still is with us. And her name is Sue Ray. And she would pull out these colored chalk, get up on the chalkboard, and she would just write about what's going on with the kidney or something like that. And she would say, and these little guys are going over here and these guys are going here. And it just made it like super fun to go to class and you were learning stuff. So learning, I think, is fun. I like learning and it's fun. And there's nothing worse than having a super boring instructor.
My wife is a teacher at a local college of psychology. And she's a neuroscientist, but I think her students get a lot out of her telling stories and having good visuals and a day of not internet-based, but real-life usage of psychology. I pick up a lot through osmosis, just all the books lying around.
Yeah, great. Yeah, when I went to college, I think my freshman year, I took a class called biological psychology, and I was learning about how they could touch electrodes on different parts of the brains. And I was like, you know what? I'm going to study this. I'm going to be a brain surgeon and I'm going to be the first one to put a computer chip into a brain. And this was like in probably like in 85 or 86. And I got too busy doing other stuff and I didn't get to that yet. But, you know, give me a couple of weeks. We'll be there.
Yeah. That is what she did, National Institute of Health and University of Arizona. Yeah, memory and aging. So there's a lot of good things happening.
Memory and aging. And that's something that I'll need to work on in some amount of decades, I guess, probably.
You know what it is. Have friends, prioritize that. Games, have a social network of really important psychology stuff.
Great, great. So let's see. I know there's a ton of stuff. Before we were talking, I was looking at your LinkedIn page and it looked like we could have 10 hours of stuff to talk about there. You've done so much and you've been in the industry for so long. But is there anything in particular that you might want to talk about or mention before we call it a day and then we could always go back later?
Sure. I thought about that even before this session. And before I left the Public Utilities Commission, I really love the people that I work with, respect them. They're doing a lot of things and not a lot of recognition. But I gave out this piece. It's called Leverage Points, Places to Intervene in a System. And it's by Danella Meadows, who's passed away and was published posthumous. And it just talks about how to be effective in changing the way things are done, and feedback loops and numbers aren't as important as the paradigm out of which the system evolved. So I guess to answer your question, I just want to point to Danella Meadows' Leverage Points, Places to Intervene in a System. I found that very valuable in everything that I do.
Okay, so I am looking this up right now, and we're going to put this in the show notes, and people can check it out. And so Leverage Points, Places to Intervene in a System. Great. Okay. Is this a book or an article?
It's 17 pages.
Okay, 17 pages.
With examples of how...
Okay, great.
Typically push in the wrong direction, but also shows how to push in the right direction and prioritizes what to focus on. And the bottom line is the paradigm out of which the system has evolved.
Okay. So, and if you want to just Google it too, it's called Leverage Points, and it is by Meadows, Donella. That's D-O-N-E-L-L-A. And it's just, there's a PDF here. It was pretty easy to find.
Great.
And we're going to all read that. We've got a homework assignment, and that's going to make you very smart and valuable if you read that, people.
Yeah, I found that very effective, and I tried to pass it on as much as possible.
Okay. And then also, do you want to like give any places where people could find you or anything like that?
energyideas@gmail.com.
Great.
That's easy.
Awesome. Everybody in the world now has your email address, but we don't want to give that to any spammers or people that are trying to sell stuff. So, well, thank you so much, Joe McCabe, ACES Fellow and all kinds of different things. And thanks for listening to Sean White's Solar and Energy Storage Podcast. To find out more, go to solarsean.com. Thanks for listening to Sean White's Solar and Energy Storage Podcast. To find out more, go to solarsean. That's solarsean.com. And you can find out there about classes, all these different places where you get all this great information, because we are in the business of education. That's right. Sticking stuff to your brain cells. Get smart.